Welcome to the Michael Rivera What Really Happened radio show.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Saturday morning. If you're watching over the studio webcam, the sun is just starting, well, not quite up over the horizon yet, but the sky is starting to get a little bit light as we head into fall, of course. The nights get longer. Even here in Hawaii, that still applies. Hurricane Ike is basically the eye has made landfall. It's down to a Category 1 storm, winds 80 miles per hour. The media, of course, is just nonstop coverage. But interestingly enough, I'm getting emails from readers and listeners in Texas who are saying that overall, the storm is not quite as bad as being portrayed in the media. They're saying that the storm surge, really, it's only homes that get flooded anyway from excessive high tides and stuff that are really being hit. And I'm not trying to minimize the suffering or anything like this, but there have been questions raised about, you know, are they running the overblowing the storm basically as to use it as a media distraction to not have to talk about the war, the economy, and various other things which are we're being distracted from. Anyway, we've got a caller on the line, and I'm going to take him real quick before we get to our guest because I want to focus on our guest when we get to him. So, Bill in Florida, aloha. What's on your mind?
Hello. Good morning, sir. Hawaii is a beautiful place. I really, really appreciate and I envy you out there. I think the controls on our system have been around for some time. I just want to mention that back in World War II, President Roosevelt told all the media and all the photographers, you know, the news photographers, that he didn't want to see any pictures of dead American soldiers. And that went right across the board. You know, so since World War II, but here's something called strategic analysis. Most Americans aren't aware of that. But it's a type of analysis where there's no gut feelings, no emotions, no emotions. It's called strategic analysis. Just like people are wondering why the POWs in Vietnam were ignored for some years. Well, strategic analysis decided that trying to rescue them would trigger, you know, more casualties, more trouble. And so therefore, because of that, that's why they didn't do anything. There were thousands of soldiers captured after World War II. Stalin made the point to kidnap many thousands of American citizens. But if the American public found out, they'd press for rescue, and the result will be a nuclear war. So I just want to...
I can see that argument, but the bottom line is the reason the Vietnamese kept the POWs is we broke our agreement to pay reparations. And so I guess that's...
this is true, but now the biggest reparation we're talking about here is that Russia, you know, was funding North Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And North Vietnam could not pay back, you know, money-wise, the huge debt. Just like in Korea, you know, the same thing in Russia, the communist countries loan many millions of dollars. So what they would do is they would take American soldiers and their people as laborers, take them into mm-hmm. Russia. There's a prison called Gask, spelled G-A-Y-S-K, and it's a Soviet prison. You can check it on the Internet. There's something like 200 high-priority American citizens there. They're kept in a special camp. Mm-hmm. They're classed as war criminals with 30, 40-year sentences of hard labor. But I just thought of a strategic analysis here this morning because I'm aware of a lot of reports. There was a report written in 1960 by, it's called the Brookings Institute, Washington, D.C. Three of the most powerful families in this country financially were on the board of directors. Mm-hmm. And they looked over information involving the American public and American welfare. And through their own economists, their own, you know, professors that are very conservative, they go behind closed doors and decide for us what we should know or not know. It's very real.
Going on a long time. Anyway, sure. Bill, I hate to cut you off, but we've got a guest waiting on the line that I really want to get into right now. So thank you. And maybe you might want to call back during hour two where I'll be free to, like, continue this discussion. But I really do want to get on to our guest.
Certainly.
So thanks a lot, Bill. Okay. All right. Waiting on the phone, we have author Stephen Wax. He's the author of a new book called Kafka Comes to America. So, Stephen, aloha. Thank you for spending time with us this Saturday morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, your publisher sent me a copy of your book a couple of weeks ago, and I have not been able to finish it all the way through. But the part that I have read so far is Well, it tells a horrific story of the depths that the United States has sunk to in terms of wrongful prosecution, framing of people, harassment, guilt by proclamation, and outright stupidity and errors. And for the benefit of our readers or our listeners who have are not familiar with the book, just give us a quick rundown on the story that it tells.
Sure. I'm a lawyer in Portland, Oregon. And in 2004, I represented a Portland lawyer named Brandon Mayfield, who was mistakenly connected by the FBI to the Madrid fingerprint, the Madrid train bombings by a fingerprint. They proclaimed that they had found a 100% match between Mr. Mayfield's print and a latent print lifted from a bag of unexploded detonators at one of the train stations in Madrid. Turned out that they were 100% wrong. In 2005, I was assigned by the federal court in Washington to represent seven of the prisoners we have been keeping in Guantanamo Bay, and for the last 3 years have been working on their cases. And in the book, what I do is weave together the stories of one of the Guantanamo prisoners and of Mr. Mayfield, describing in lay terms, this is not a legal book, what happened to them and how they were in the one instance falsely accused and the other instance falsely connected to the bombing.
Well, I remember when the story first came out, I remember reading about the lawyer case up in Portland, Oregon, and we were seeing a lot of what seemed to be very reckless accusations and there was this, I'd almost call it a bum's rush to try and demonize anybody that might have any connections. Well, just the Muslim charities were being taken down, websites were being taken down, and really kind of reminded a lot of observers of the kind of abuses that we saw in Germany directed against the Jews just prior to World War II. And it's for that reason a lot of people were paying attention to this. And I remember reading ultimately how it turned out that that one single fingerprint on which all of this stuff had been based turned out it was completely wrong, that it wasn't a match at all. It wasn't even close. It was just a rush. They wanted to get somebody to blame, and he was it. And in a way, it almost reminded me of the case of Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who got railroaded for the kidnapping and, for the death of the Lindbergh baby just because of the political pressure to find and punish somebody, and it really didn't matter who.
Well, Mike, I was not present in the FBI offices or in the Department of Justice at the time that Brandon was arrested. So I really can't offer any comments, and I don't in the book offer any comments or opinions about why he was taken into custody. What I do is set out the facts, and the facts themselves gave rise to serious concerns about religious profiling, which would be a phrase one could use to describe what you were just talking about. And it led to questions about religious profiling and the way in which the Muslim American community was being treated in a number of hearings on Capitol Hill. And those questions arose initially from the very affidavit submitted by the FBI to the federal court in support of its request for the arrest warrant for Brandon and for warrants to search his home and his law office. Because in that affidavit, the FBI started with the fingerprint. And they told the court that there was a 100% match between Brandon's print and this latent print lifted from the bag of detonators. But the affidavit then went on in terms of the listing of other factors to support his arrest and the searches to say he was a Muslim. It said he's married to an Egyptian who's a Muslim. It said he's been seen attending a mosque. The affidavit said he's a lawyer and that he had represented a man who had been convicted of a terrorism offense in a child custody battle and that his client held anti-American and anti-Semitic views.
Okay, Stephen, we got to take a break here.
Sorry.
Match Music means we got to sell some products, so we're going to be back here with Stephen Wax after these words from our sponsors.
Cascade Radio. Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. Our guest today is Stephen Wax, author of Kafka Comes to America. And for those of you who have never read the plays of Franz Kafka, you've got to go check them out, and then you'll understand the reference of what's going on here. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the FBI's justification for the searches, arrests, and essentially the persecution. They started out with a fingerprint that they claimed they had a 100% match. I would be suspicious of that statement there, because fingerprint matches are based on points. Points of match between the exemplar and the evidentiary fingerprint, and I forget what the current courtroom standard is, but I think it's something like 11 points have to match. And but it's always talk about point. They never talk about percentage, and that statement right there is therefore suspect. So setting aside the fingerprint, which we now know was not a match at all, the entire reason for all the searches and arrests and harassment was just that the targets were Muslim.
Well, Mike, as I was saying about the affidavit, it speaks for itself. And what the Congress inquired into when they were looking into this, and what a number of people in the community here in Oregon were quite upset about, was the way in which the affidavit referenced Brandon's religion. And, you know, that gave rise to concerns about religious profiling. In 2006, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, Glenn Fine, published a report on the Mayfield matter. And one of the things that he had inquired into was whether or not Brandon's religion had played any role in the arrest and in the determination to continue the investigation on him from March through May. And his answer was that a number of people involved in the case had said, no, religion did not play any role. But a number of others did. And in my judgment, those people were being, were better able to assess what was actually going on in their minds. Because one of the things they said was that the fact that he was Muslim gave them some comfort. It gave them some comfort that they were on the right track. And that it was indeed a factor in the investigation. And so that comes from the Department of Justice reports itself. You don't need to look anywhere else. You don't need to speculate about what was going on. And just see, even the Department of Justice recognized that fact.
Well, you know, that's a very, very strange word there, comfort. It kind of implies that had Muslims not been involved, that there would have been a reason for them to be uncomfortable with the way the affidavit was filled out or the way the investigation was being handled. And that almost, and I'm speculating here, and I realize as a lawyer you don't want to do that, but it almost sounds to me like maybe they already knew right from the get-go that there was doubt about the fingerprint. And
you don't need to speculate about that, Mike, because in the record and in the book, I actually reproduced a copy of the letter that the Spanish sent to the FBI in mid-April, 3 weeks before Brandon was arrested. And their letter said that their fingerprint analysis with respect to Brandon was negative. Unless there be any mistake about what it was that they were saying, they actually bolded the word negative in the letter. After the FBI received that letter, they sent a team of people to Spain, met with the Spanish, and what they reported to the court when they sought Brandon's arrest was that at the end of that meeting, they were convinced that the Spanish now agreed with them. Well, I personally spoke with the head of the Spanish forensic police, and he told me that that is not what happened. Now, he had also spoken with a reporter from the New York Times, and if I'm remembering correctly, it's the June 5 edition of the Times from 2004 that has a detailed article in which they explain what they were told. And it's one of the things that I go into also in the book, the conversation that I personally had with this man, that says that the Spanish had told the government before the arrest that it wasn't Brandon's print, and that what the FBI reported afterwards was not consistent with what the Spanish said happened.
Okay, so let me sort of recap where we're at. We have an FBI that is aware they don't really have a match on the fingerprint, but they're going ahead and searching this guy's home and his business and just basically making his life a mess, but they're taking comfort that it's okay to do because he's Muslim.
Well, you've got to keep in mind, Mike, that they would disagree with what you said, because their perspective was that the Spanish had agreed with them. And I think it's important to keep in mind that there's another report that people can take a look at, and it's also a report that I discussed in the book, and that is, in the summer of 2004, the FBI convened an international panel of experts to try to figure out what happened, what went wrong. And that panel of experts concluded that what went wrong was two different things. One they called confirmation bias. They said that after the first FBI examiner thought that he had found a match, instead of having a separate, independent, scientific reexamination, the first guy calls the second guy over and says, in essence, you know, hey, Joe, you know, look at the computer screen. Looks like a match. Oh, yeah, looks like a match. And then they did the same thing with a third person, abandoning the scientific method, and this international panel, convened by the FBI, faulted them for that. Second thing they said was that the mistake was made because of what they called big case pressures. And this may be something akin to what you were referring to, big case pressures. What they're saying is that the FBI, all our government officials, have a very heavy responsibility to keep us safe, to prevent any future terrorist attacks, and to solve those that have taken place. And what this international panel said is that some of the people in the FBI, and I think this is applicable throughout the government, in essence start working with blinders on. The desire to do their job as they see it causes them to lose perspective, increases the likelihood of mistakes, making bad judgments, causes them, in essence, to see what they expect to see and not to be able to take in things that are inconsistent. So I think that, again, one can just look to an official government examination and see how the criticisms of what occurred can play out. We don't need to speculate. We don't need to impugn the motives of some of the people. In terms of what happens here in Oregon with the people with whom I've been working in the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, I don't question their motives. You know, my sense is that these are people of goodwill attempting to do their jobs. They had the facts wrong, and they were relying on a group of people who got carried away.
Well, I'm perhaps willing to be a little bit less generous with the FBI than you are, and mostly that has to do with the long experience with COINTELPRO and butting heads with them on a couple of other issues, and I'll go into that in a little more detail after we come back from this current break. Meanwhile, if anybody would like to join us on the air and ask Stephen Wax some questions, the number is 800-259-9231. Ethan is answering the phones today, so call in and talk to us. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Fear and hate will rule them, said the demon to his throne. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. Our guest today is Stephen Wax. We're talking about his book, Kafka Comes to America, and it tells this horrific story of abuse by the FBI. And Stephen's point of view is that It's just enthusiasm and wanting to see what they want to see. I have a somewhat more cynical view, having been through the whole situation when Frederick Whitehurst blew the whistle and said that the FBI lab routinely falsified test results in order to aid prosecutions. And, of course, having gone around with them going all the way back to the Black Panther coloring book in the COINTELPRO days against Vietnam, the staged peace riot at Disneyland, which was carried out by the FBI, and various other abuses from the COINTELPRO era. So I'm more inclined to think that they knew the fingerprint did not match, that they really did believe the Spanish results, that they merely said the Spanish now agree with us, it's a matched fingerprint. But frankly, the fact that there was this need for this meeting, for the FBI to go to Spain and talk it over with them, you know, basically tells me, you know, they knew there was a problem, or they should have known there was a problem, because fingerprints either match or don't. It's not 100% match if you're having this huge debate about it. And again, as you said, the documents indicate that the fact that their target was a Muslim was a source of comfort to them, that this somehow made such behavior completely acceptable. And again, this was a mindset we saw back during the 1960s when the FBI was carrying out essentially criminal acts against the peace movement, the early civil rights movement, early feminists, Native Americans. The fact that these were sort of designated villains of the society made it more comfortable and acceptable to do these kinds of things. And it seems like we've not really learned the lesson of the 1960s and 1970s if we're seeing this kind of behavior still taking place here at the dawn of the 21st century.
Well, there certainly are records of abuse that go back, not just to the 60s. You can go back to the beginnings of the FBI when J. Edgar Hoover was working with Attorney General Mitchell Palmer in 1919-1920, rounding up what were then known as Reds in one of the Red Scares after the end of World War One and the Russian Revolution. My point is this. There are certain things that we can know by observing. There are certain things we can speculate about. And what I try to do in the book is to deal with those things that I personally observed with respect to Brannon and with respect to Guantanamo. And, in the book, I do put a number of things into historical perspective and talk about the Palmer raid, talk about the Japanese internments, and talk about a number of the abuses that took place in the protest movement in the 60s against the Vietnam War, Watergate, et cetera. It seems to me that one of the places where we can all find what I would say is evidence of the motivations of some of our top government officials in this war on terror, is in the Guantanamo cases. Because in the Guantanamo cases, you can find in the historic record available online and in any number of publications the actual memos written to justify the enhanced interrogation techniques, what some people call torture, to justify abandoning the Geneva Conventions, to justify putting the men in isolation in Guantanamo. And you can even read the arguments that the Bush administration has made in the U.S. Supreme Court, in which they were saying to the Supreme Court that the president could unilaterally seize and detain people. That's their view of presidential power. And fortunately, this past June, the Supreme Court rejected that and did so with a long historic discussion. Going back to Magna Carta, talking about how the English stripped the power of their kings to do the types of things that President Bush has asserted to the Supreme Court that he has the power to do. It is important to note that that decision was 5-4. And, in terms of the makeup of the court, it's quite significant in terms of who gets to make appointments and how that thing splits out. Four justices agreeing with the administration that the president could unilaterally seize and imprison people indefinitely with no process, without any judicial review. Five of the justices saying no. That power was taken from the English kings more than 400 years ago, and it doesn't exist in America. So you can see the motivations in their writing, in these memos.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I look to and talk about because those are things we can observe, we can read, we can analyze, and we can say that shows us how they view the extent of the power that they have and why they're acting in the way in which they are.
Well, Stephen, I hope you did not get the wrong impression. We may have a difference of opinion regarding the motives and willingness of the FBI, but I think that your book is a very important one, and because it is based on the facts and evidence that you've presented and collected together, I think it is an important book for people to be reading. So before we let you go here, where do you have an online website, or where can they go to get your book?
Well, the book is available in bookstores, I wish I could say everywhere, but throughout the country. It's available online from Amazon, Borders, Powell's. It's carried in many of the Borders and Barnes & Noble's. It's carried in many of the independent bookstores. And in terms of website, information about it is available through the publisher, which is Other Press. I'm drawing a blank on their web address.
If people type Kafka Comes to America into Google search engine, I'm sure they're going to find lots of places where they can find it.
I think they will.
And it is definitely a book that you should get and buy it, read it, then share it with your friends. And I think in many ways it's almost as an important a book as Day of Deceit and various other books, which are very well researched, very factual. Not a lot of speculation, which is a good thing in a work of this nature. And I can imagine probably there are a lot of people inside the FBI who are not going to be happy about the book. But at the same time, you know, we have obligations as citizens to hold these agencies to a high standard of behavior.
Well, I agree entirely, Mike. And one of the things that I think it's important for everyone, you know, listening to keep in mind is that we have the First Amendment in the Constitution, which, as I see it, gives us not only the right, but the obligation to speak out, to associate, to voice our political views, whatever they may be. And I view, the issues that we're dealing with here as not political issues. They're issues that go to the fundamental core structure of our country, how we're going to preserve our democracy.
Okay, well, we're going to let you go at the end of this segment, but before you do, I wanted to get your feedback. We have a story that broke today. The rules for the FBI have just been changed, and whereas before individual agents had to get approval of a bureau supervisor to move into an investigation, apparently under the new rules, individual agents can take it upon themselves to conduct physical surveillance, solicit informants, and interview people who know what may be a potential target of investigation. And I know a lot of civil libertarians, and I'm concerned. This seems like the FBI agents are just given a fishing license to just start going out and doing whatever they feel like. And how is this going to dovetail with this idea that it's somehow more comfortable to abuse the civil rights of Muslims?
Well, unfortunately, Mike, I haven't seen that new regulation, so I can't comment directly on it, but I can say this. There's no question that in any group of human beings, whether it's FBI agents, lawyers, or radio commentators and announcers, you've got good people and you've also got a few rotten apples. And one of the things that has been so important over the years is to have checks on the individual. And in any number of cases, the Supreme Court has warned us all against what the Supreme Court calls the competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime, the way in which law enforcers can get carried away. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment.
We got to let you go here, Stephen. Thank you very much for spending time with us today, and we will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're coming up in the end of hour number one. The sun is up there out the window if you're watching through the webcam here. I'm watching the media feeds here, the coverage of Hurricane Ike, and it's definitely a problem for a lot of people there. There is a considerable amount of flooding and a lot of wind. I've been through the eye of two hurricanes in my life, so been there and done that, and it can be very, very rough. Other news that's breaking, of course, is the commuter train accident yesterday in the San Fernando Valley in California, which is where I used to live. And apparently a commuter train hit a freight train, so somebody made a mistake somewhere on the routing on that one. Hackers have apparently broken into one of the computers at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland. At latest reports, they stole the value of pi, the square root of 2, and Euler's constant. Investigation is still continuing at this point. Now, up in Alaska, yes, we're going to get back to Sarah Palin. Up in Alaska, the House Judiciary Committee has unanimously approved the Troopergate subpoenas, which are going out, including to Sarah Palin's husband. And apparently the state senator from the town of Wasilla, where Palin used to be mayor, also voted for the subpoenas. So it seems like support for Sarah, or at least defending of her, is very much on the wane up in Alaska. And it may be, this kind of this wisdom in this old saying, be very careful who you step on your way up, because you're probably going to meet them on your way back down again. So, definitely want to be taking a look at that. Now, getting back into the economy, which is one of the stories that is really not being covered either by the political campaigns or by our TV media. As you know, Lehman Brothers appears to be on the way out. There was talk of possibly some kind of a taxpayer bailout over the weekend ahead of the opening of the Asian markets tomorrow night. This apparently triggered a very negative reaction among the taxpayers. No big surprise there. And now the talk is that Bank of America may take over Lehman Brothers. The problem there is there are experts on Wall Street who are looking at Bank of America's own exposures and thinking that the combined entity of Bank of America and Lehman might itself collapse, that Lehman Brothers could drag Bank of America down with it. And sometimes you need to be careful, because you get into this merger idea and this this dream of building a much larger entity, and it can tempt you to some very foolish actions. And I remember years ago, when I was just starting out in show business, I worked for a company called Robert Abel and Associates, and was with them for a great many years and had a lot of fun. It was a great experience, and I look back on with a certain amount of nostalgia. And then toward the end there, they decided they wanted to become these really large companies. So actually, it was a Canadian company called Omnibus that decided they wanted to create a whole bunch of new, a really huge powerhouse company. And they came down to Los Angeles and they bought Robert Abel and Associates and Digital Productions and built this huge new combined company that we were inside calling DigiOmnibusable. And everybody had been sort of fudging on the books, and nobody knew how much debt there really was involved with these various companies. And the huge new combined entity was in business for about 3 months, and then it fell apart. So based on that personal experience, I would strongly urge Bank of America to be very careful about acquiring Lehman Brothers. Do your due diligence and everything. And I know everyone says, well, they're banks. Of course they're going to they're going to be very careful about these things. No, banks make stupid mistakes, or we would not be in the mess that we're in right now. And so definitely some caution needs to be there. Now, Liechtenstein has been in the news lately, because up until recently, they were one of the places where very rich people could send their money on vacation and not have to pay taxes on it. And we all know in the United States, in point of fact, that taxation is not fair. Taxes are paid predominantly by the middle class. The lower classes don't make that much money, so of course they pay far less taxes. The really rich people have enough money to be able to hire lawyers and accountants to basically move the money around and shield it with corporations and shelters and basically send their money off to places like Liechtenstein where they can let it accumulate and not pay taxes on it. I mean, there's other places like the Cayman Islands and so forth. But apparently Liechtenstein has decided that it is tired of being this tax haven, or at least some people working within it continue to out some of the very wealthy people who are using it to hide their money. And I think the point of this whole story is going to be a growing awareness within the United States and around the world that in point of fact the taxation systems are never fair. That tax reform is always some version of let's make other people pay the taxes for the things we want to get from the government, whether it's medical care or I want a huge defense contract to make my business rich, but let's make that group of people over there pay for it. Here in the United States, when the Republicans are in power, the tax burden shifts onto the Democrats. When the Democrats are in power, the tax burden shifts back onto the Republicans, and it goes back and forth. And nobody really deals with the issue that maybe taxes across the board are too high. But the net result of this, of course, is that we have this hideously complex tax code. And I know the politicians like to get there and say, well, the tax code is ultimately fair and honest. And that is nonsense. If the tax code in the United States was fair, it would fit into a pamphlet. It would say, everybody pays this percentage, or everybody pays this flat rate. And it would be simple, and everybody could see it, and there wouldn't be any questions about it. Instead, we have a tax code that fills volume after volume after volume after volume, and everything in it is a special favor to a special group to, like, let them off the hook for taxes on this little area and that little area. And the accumulating benefit of all these little tiny tax benefits and loopholes and policies is that certain favored people with a lot of political connections, i.e. the big campaign donors, are allowed to shirk a chunk of their taxes, and of course that tax burden must then fall onto other people who don't have access to lawyers and lobbyists and tax shelters. And so the bottom line is when you see a tax code that is that huge and that obfuscated, it is a prima facie sign that it's not a fair taxation system. It really, really isn't. And of course there's a great number of people, and I am one of them, who think that the real reason, one of the major reasons the tax code is as complex as it is to hide the fact that it may not even be legal. And certainly we have cases like Sullivan versus United States where the judge in the case, James C. Fox, states right in the court record that the 16th Amendment was not actually ratified. And then he goes on to say, well, you know, we've gotten away with it this long, there's no point in trying to change it. So basically, it's an admission right there. The law is what the government says it is, not what the people vote for. And that right there is another indication that we really are living in a dictatorship, a very soft and fluffy dictatorship with matching coordinated fashion colors, but it's still a dictatorship. And I think the clearest evidence of that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, call in and tell me if I'm wrong, I always vote for the guy who says he's going to lower the taxes. And somehow taxes keep going up. We all ultimately vote with our wallets, and we're going to vote for the people that we think, or they tell us, they're going to improve our quality of life. Taxes are going to get lowered, and we're going to have economic opportunity to basically transform our labor into a higher standard of living for ourselves and our children. And obviously, we have not been getting that. The only people who got tax breaks over the last 8 years were the very wealthy people who are sending their money to Liechtenstein. In fact, when Bush put out those tax cuts for the rich, basically echoing Reagan's trickle-down theory that if we let the rich get really rich, they'll trickle all over us and the benefits will spread throughout the entire society. And it sounds really good. But at the time, given that we had already lost our manufacturing to a large degree, I said, you know, they're just going to take the money and they're going to get it out of the country. And it's not going to benefit the society as a whole for these people to be getting the tax breaks. And that's exactly what happened. We got to take a break here for some news. We'll be back after the news break with hour number two of the What Really Happened radio show. So stay tuned and call in and join us. And we'll be back after the news break. Aloha.
Welcome to the Michael Rivera What Really Happened Radio Show.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to hour two of our show. Greetings to our ground affiliates across the country who are tuning in on their AM and FM radios. And let's see, we've got some callers on the line here. And before we get to them, though, I want to respond to some emails that I was getting over the news break here. Last segment of the previous hour, I made a joke about the hackers breaking into the computers at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN and stealing the value of pi. And I got some emails, and it's usual emails about, oh, you're always bad-mouthing the hackers, and they're really harmless, and, you know, why are you always going after them like that? And, well, you know, most of them are criminals. You know, they're loading up my mailbox with Viagra ads that I really don't need. And but the big issue here is, I mean, there has been a lot of concern expressed about the Large Hadron Collider possibly bringing about the end of the world. Now, personally, I think there's a lot of nonsense to that speculation, but still, there is no question this is a very, very powerful device, capable of inflicting a lot of damage, at least on those people standing around it, inadvertently firing some high-energy proton beams right through the ground, and we don't really know. The bottom line is, if it ran out of control, how much damage it would inflict. And yet we've got all these people who are so concerned that this thing could possibly bring about the end of the world, and so what's the first thing they do? They break into it and start tinkering around. You know, this is like seeing a nuclear bomb in front of you that's already armed and ry to go, and just for the heck of it, you pry off the access panel and start poking around with a screwdriver just to see what might happen. And you have to realize that's what these hackers are doing. They're breaking into the computers that control this very, very powerful machine that so many people are worried about could conceivably create a black hole right here on Earth and suck everything into it. And regardless of whether you think that might or might not happen, there's a degree of recklessness and callousness on display here from these people who are doing this. So that's all I'm going to basically say on that subject. And before we get back to the news, looks like one of our callers dropped. Please call back in. We would love to hear from you. And we're going to go to Clarence in Oklahoma. Clarence, aloha. Welcome to the show.
How's it going there, Mike?
Well, so far, so good. I mean, the sun is finally up over there in the east, and looks like it's going to be a clear and gorgeous day out here. Yesterday was all kind of muggy and stormy and rainy and wet, which was annoying the house painters a lot, but it's going to be a beautiful day. Once the show's over, my wife and I are going to go out and do what husbands and wives do on Saturday mornings.
Well, I at least my cousin there on Maui will enjoy that.
Yes.
And so, as a I'll tell you one thing. First off, you always wonder why sometimes you know there are people listening because you can check the servers and then
yes,
the other, and you know they're, but they don't call in. And I'm going to tell you why, and this is a compliment. You have so much good, you're so prepared and have so much good research and so many good stories. I just want to sit there and listen and take in all the information, you know. It's really hard to come up with something to say, you know. I mean, you're just laying it all right out there, you know.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry, and I realize it's a compliment, and thank you for the compliment, but this radio show and the website are really intended to be a community effort, and I rely on people who send me information into the website to point me at stories that are developing, and I like it when people call in with a different perspective. And, you know, it is a little frustrating when I sit here and talk for 2 hours straight and nobody's calling in. And, yes, I know they're listening. I've got very good numbers out there on the servers and everything. But I like having people call in. And,
what I was going to say is, you know, I very rarely disagree with you. I can't remember the times I have. But about the only thing I can do is try to think of something to call in to add. That's where I have my problem, you know. Because I have to, like the thing you... I was originally going to talk about the income tax thing before the break, and then you come up and have that excellent deal that I remember you talked about earlier about this CERN, yeah, I think it's CERN, yeah, deal where, you know, the hackers hack in, and I was just thinking, you know, that you said, you know, that's like taking that plate off that atomic bomb. That reminded me of the old scene in the old movie Goldfinger, where James Bond's trapped down in, you know, in the, you know, in Fort Knox with all the gold, and they've got that big deal, a big looking, looks like a big old case on wheels there, and he opens it up, and he's And he's watching it tick down, you know, the seconds. It's got a timer on it, and it's coming down, and he's looking in there, and he doesn't know which wire to pull or what to push on. Or, but he gets saved in the end, you know. And,
of course, he's James Bond, yes.
Yeah, exactly, always. But that's the thing, you know, I was thinking about that. That brought me to a whole other thought. You talked about this degree of recklessness.
Yes.
There seems to be on the part of these scientists that are doing this type of thing. And
well, no, I was talking about the hackers who are breaking into the computers.
Oh, the degree of their recklessness. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they're playing around with it. Well, even sometimes I'll say this. Now, I agree or disagree. I wonder about, I know these scientists, they say, well, we're pretty sure that nothing's going to happen. Well, when they exploded the first atomic bomb at Trinity Site in New Mexico back in 1945 in July, there was a going bet, because I've read a couple of books about that. There was a going bet among the top physicists there, and that they were afraid that by setting that bomb off on a test, it might ignite the atmosphere and destroy the Earth. That was the extent that their knowledge of physics wasn't as up to date as it is today, and they said about a 20% chance is what they figured. And they took bets. Now, of course, I don't know if they'd have been, you know, if whoever was right about it blowing the place up or destroying it, I don't know who's going to collect, but, you know, that's the way they looked at it. So,
let me give you an insight about that. Now, first of all, you know, I come from a scientific background, and I am very cautious about certain things. As you know, I've been very questioning of the global warming hype, which I see is really just kind of a scam to trick people out of taxes and so forth. I have been very, very concerned about the displayed recklessness with regards to genetic engineering and putting some genetic engineering products out there in the market before they're ready. And, of course, now we've got the news from France that their natural shellfish population, which they harvest and market as a product, has been decimated by a genetically engineered life form that was introduced to try and bolster productivity, and instead it's horribly backfired, and they've got major, major problems on their hands. I also agree that, you know, caution definitely has to be exercised if you're dealing with anything that could even potentially create a tiny black hole, because that is definitely the irrevocable accident, should it happen. Now, that being said, looking back at the Trinity blast, it really is more a case of chemistry than physics. And you need to remember, when you have a project like Trinity, where you've got all these different people, some are mechanical engineers, and some are chemists, and some are physicists, and some are shockwave specialists, and the concern that the atmosphere was going to ignite was coming from people who really didn't have the knowledge to understand why that really was not going to happen. And yes, within the heat of the bomb itself and immediately nearby, you're going to get the nitrogen and the oxygen in the atmosphere to combine into nitrous oxide. But it wouldn't be self-sustaining, because the energy that comes out of such a combination is not enough to perpetuate the reaction much further than the nuclear weapon blast itself. So the people who were making that bet, the 20%, were the ones they were mechanical engineers, not chemists, and they basically got taken. On the other hand, it was a new technology, and there were some accidents that did kill some people, so you do need to be careful about that. Now, as far as the CERN experiment is concerned, I tend to be in agreement with Stephen Hawking that they're probably not going to find the Higgs boson that they're looking for. My objection to the Large Hadron Collider, yes, there's going to be some real science that is going to come out of there that's really very valuable. But the real problem I have with it is it's not really a scientific instrument. It's a religious one. They've spent all this money to build this machine to try and prove that there was a supreme moment of divine creation long, long ago, even though current physics says it's so full of contradictions that it's really very hard to continue to subscribe to this theory. And we're going to hit a break here. So, Clarence, we're going to stop right now, but hold that thought. We're going to hold you through the break, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the Big Bang Theory, the Large Hadron Collider, black holes, and why science and religion is a very, very bad mix to have. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Cascadia Public
Radio.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We've got Clarence on the phone from Oklahoma. We're talking about the Big Bang Theory, the Large Hadron Collider, you know, small stuff like that. And I want to, for the benefit of our listeners who really aren't physics students, because it's a wonderfully variable world and different people are into different things, but I want to go back here. When Edwin Hubble discovered the red shift, he himself did not claim that this proved the universe was expanding. Edwin Hubble knew that a Doppler redshifted spectrum meant there was a relative velocity, but he didn't rule out that there might not be some other phenomenon operating over the vastness of space that was also redshifting the spectrum. We know from studying the spectrum of the sun that really powerful magnetic fields can actually create multiple copies of the same spectral line at slightly different shifts in frequency. And this is particularly noticeable around the sunspots, of which our sun seems devoid at the particular moment. So Hubble himself did not feel comfortable making the assumptions about what the redshift he saw meant. It was for subsequent scientists to basically say, oh, it must mean the universe is expanding. There couldn't possibly be any other explanation. And that means that if you rewind through time, we come back to a supreme moment of creation. And this was a very popular theory, especially with people who are of a religious nature, because they love this idea that in the beginning, God sneezed and the universe came for us, or whatever it actually says in there. And so as a result, the Big Bang Theory gained ground against alternative theories such as the steady state theory. And the steady state theory, basically in a nutshell, is that since most of space is really nothing, you can't have a beginning and an end to nothing. And therefore, the universe is infinite in both directions in time. And I'm old enough to where both of these theories were still considered viable. But over time and under duress of people with a religious bent, the Big Bang Theory became accepted. And the problem is that over the intervening years, more and more contradictions have surfaced. The biggest one, of course, is that when this primordial egg appeared, it would have been the most supermassive black hole possible. And you need to remember, the Big Bang Theory came into fashion and vogue before the idea of black holes was really understood, before the idea that you could have a gravity field so intense that even light could not escape. And so you ran into this contradiction. And immediately, those scientists who were heavily invested in their personal religious beliefs and who were heavily invested in the Big Bang Theory, having taught and researched it and gotten grants for it throughout their careers and not about ready to say, whoopsie, we were wrong, started inventing all these complex reasons why the laws of physics didn't work for the first few moments of the universe's creation. If you've ever seen that little cartoon about the scientist with the blackboard, and it's got all these numbers, and then down in the middle part it says, and then the magic happened, and then there's a bunch of numbers after that. It really is like that. Most of modern cosmology is an attempt to explain or justify the belief, the faith, that for the first few moments of the universe's creation, the normal rules of physics didn't apply. And to justify that. Now, to me, this sounds an awful lot like the science of epicycles. And the science of epicycles was this complex theory that was created to reconcile the religiously desirable theory of the Earth as the center of the entire universe with the fact that we could see the planets occasionally go backwards in their path in the sky, what's called retrograde motion. Now, we understand now that the Earth is not the center of the universe. It's not even the center of the solar system. The sun is. We're just one planet that whips around it. And as we overtake the outer planets from our point of view on the Earth, they will momentarily appear to travel backwards in the sky. And it makes perfect sense. But those scientists back in the Middle Ages who didn't want to challenge the religious dogma of Earth as the center of the universe, instead of looking at the evidence and saying this contradicts the prime assumption, they invented this complex theory of epicycles, why there were these strange invisible mechanisms in the sky that would occasionally haul the planets back in the wrong direction. And it was a very complex and mathematically sophisticated explanation. And, of course, it was flat out wrong. And we seem to be in the same situation now. We have a theory for the creation of the universe that is very desired by religious institutions, but it's contradicted by the observed evidence, and there's more and more evidence always coming out about it that contradicts it, such as the awareness of black holes, the fact that the observed redshift in the sky is actually quantized and not continuous, the fact that the background, what is claimed to be the background radiation from the Big Bang, doesn't match the theory of what it should look like had it come from the Big Bang. In fact, in my opinion, what we're seeing is the remnants of a gigantic planetary nebula from our unique position at its very center. That aeons ago, a nearby star went nova, and this huge bubble of gas is spread out all around us on all sides, and that's what Kobe picked up. But to get back to it, one of the explanations for why the universe could come into existence despite being this huge black hole goes on to this particle called the Higgs boson, which is this ultra-dense particle that at the moment it's created immediately breaks off into a whole bunch of other different particles from which the universe was then created. And the fact that this is really an attempt to prove a moment of creation for religious reasons is revealed by the fact that they call it the God particle. And so this huge collider at CERN, and yes, there'll be real science coming out of it, but it was built to try and reassert a religious theory for the creation of the universe. And the logical flaw in all this thinking is, even if they're able to cram some protons together hard enough and energetically enough to create something that looks like this Higgs boson, does not prove they ever existed before then. At the energy levels of these colliders, you cannot rule out the possibility that these particles that they're seeing come out of these things are being created right there and then for the first time, that they're not in fact some fundamental part of the universe, but could be the shrapnel from these high-energy collisions. I mean, particle physics is basically like taking two wristwatches and slamming them together at the speed of sound and then trying to figure out what they originally were from the fragments that flew out. That's really exactly what's going on. Clarence, I know I didn't let you get a chance to talk here, but stick around for the next segment. I want to hear your feedback when we get back, okay? Is Clarence not there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. All right. Hang on. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Shackles we will bind them to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars from land security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've got Clarence on the phone from Oklahoma. And Clarence, I kind of blew right through that last segment without letting you talk.
Yes, I just want to say, I'm glad you did, because that's a great exposition. It reminded me of why I only got a C in general physical science when I went to college. And
well, you remember in high school the fat kid with the slide rule on his belt, the football players would beat him up to do their homework?
Oh yeah.
That was me.
Yeah, I bet you had a pocket protector, too.
Yes, I did. I confess. I had a pocket protector with little pocket microscope and all the rest of that stuff.
The whole
nine yards.
Yes, I remember.
Ran the projector for the teacher and all the rest of that stuff.
Yes. You're giving my age away and everything else, too.
Well, I just gave mine away, too. So.
Oh, well, yeah. So.
Hey, but listen, Nerds of America, I got to say this. Nerds of America, if you've got the plastic pocket protector and you're running the projector, it's cool because I wound up working on a hot TV show doing the visual effects for them. So, you know, stick with it. You're on the right track.
That's it. I wish I'd have been better at math, but they were just switching over at that time when I was in junior high, and I'm going to say it was back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to this new special math. It was a new way of teaching. They're going to do the whole thing.
The new math.
And look, children aren't just taught by their parents. This is what I was thinking during the break. Or not by their teachers. They're taught by their parents, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they should be.
Take your homework home and you give it to your, you know, and say, help me with my homework.
Mm-hmm.
They came out with that new stuff, and my dad was a World War II veteran. He was born in 1914. He took math, you know, what the regular was. He looked at that book that I brought home, and he couldn't make heads nor tails of it. So he couldn't help me, consequently. So, and he couldn't afford a tutor, so consequently, I'm math challenged to this day. I can use a calculator, and that's about it.
I think pretty much everybody in education looks back at new math as being a huge disaster. It was one of the first things that started to really sever the parent as teaching adjunct.
It sure did. Absolutely.
And if you ever remember, there was this wonderful guy by the name of Tom Lehrer who wrote these wonderful songs. He was on That Was the Week That Was, and he did a bunch of albums.
I remember that show.
And he did a song on new math that really hit it. And he would always preface the song by saying the whole idea of new math is to understand what you're doing rather than to get the right answer. And he was absolutely true. It needlessly obfuscated mathematics. It was supposed to be this new hip thing, and it was a disaster. And it's one of the reasons why the United States workforce has lost its technological edge compared to the rest of the world.
And, you know, and saying that, that brings back the idea, you know. As I understand, Einstein had problems with quantum physics when that came out.
He just flat out didn't agree with it.
Well, that's it. He didn't. He said, God does not play dice with the universe or something like that.
Yeah, that was his way of putting it. And then he had that famous debate with Niels Bohr.
Mm-hmm.
But toward the end of his life, he did realize that the quantum mechanical universe was definitely real in there, and he tried to create a theory that would explain
of everything.
The grand unified field theory,
the unified
and he failed
field
to do
theory.
It.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, when I was thinking about that whole thing right there, that just tells you, sometimes, though, these scientists, like you were talking, I think what they try to do is they try to make the observations fit the theory rather than the other way around.
Yes, that's a constant problem. And that's one of the reasons, and you need to understand that scientific method is a device for arriving at truth because it's supposed to exclude the human element. A person who is a scientist is still a human being with all the weaknesses of a human being. The whole point of scientific method with, cross-checks and double-blind and the rest of it is to get that human element out. Unfortunately, what it can't get out is the political element because, you know, the golden rule of science is whoever has the gold makes the rules. And this is why, you know, if you hold up several $1 billion in funding for global warming, all the scientists are going to say, ooh, I'm a global warming expert. I'm a global warming expert. Give me money. I got to make my mortgage payments. And as a result of that, we do get a lot of bad science. We get science driven by corporations, and stuff gets put out there that is not adequately tested. Again, getting back to the whole genetic modification problem. And again, scientists are human beings, and they're driven by their beliefs. And when you get scientists who are being driven by religious belief and trying to prove the Bible with their scientific skills, they're not acting scientifically. They're acting like, you know, priests that just happen to have a science degree. And we've seen a lot of really dumb things come out of it. I mean, we've got people who are trying to teach that humans coexisted with the dinosaurs so that they can go back to claiming that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And they say, hey, I'm a scientist. This means it must be right. And no, it isn't, because scientific method is a means of intellectual activity that operates outside human agency. And if you're not allowing it to do that, you know, with peer review and fact check, and reproducibility above all else, then it's not science, it's just superstition.
Well, I'll say this in closing. I don't want to take up too much time or dominate here. In the end, we all have human foibles, and scientists are
yes.
no different than any
yes.
other person on this planet. And what we run into, and I'll never forget when I was taking my I had to take general, and I was afraid of it because I knew the math was going to be a bear for me since they'd messed me up on that. But what I found out was I asked the instructor one day. I said, do all the scientific laws we witness about around us and that we observe, are these operant in all areas of our universe? And he said, definitely yes, they are operant in all areas of our universe. But then again, there's always that area of doubt in my mind. How can we know? Then if you come up to black holes, and the theories of physics that they speculate don't hold up in a black hole. At least what we observe.
The physics works around the black holes. Where it breaks down is trying to reconcile the black hole with a Big Bang expanding universe.
That's
you know,
right there. Yeah, that singularity, yeah. And that's what I wanted to get at. You talked about two, and I remember the steady state theory and the Big Bang theory, and then there was a steady state. There was also, and I don't know where this one went, the Big Crunch theory. You know what
that is?
That's
still out there. That's still out there.
Yeah. They believe that, that at some point in time it'll stop and all just fall back in, and there's a word for it. It's where like it'll fall back into a singularity again, and then at some point in time explode out again, and a whole new universe is created.
Yeah, and
a whole new universe comes into being.
It just pogos, you know, out, in, out, in, out, in.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's an interesting theory, but you have to remember that all of these theories of expanding universe and crunching theory and all the rest of it are all based on one assumption, the observed redshift in the universe, one observation, the observed redshift, and the assumption that there is no other explanation for that redshift than relative velocity. And this goes all the way back to Aristotle, who for the most part was a very sharp guy, but he did make some mistakes. And one mistake that he made was he took an orange, threw it up in the air, and it came straight back down into his hand. And he said, the Earth must be sitting absolutely still, because otherwise, when I threw the orange up, it would fly off to one side. And so Aristotle, on the basis of his one observed experiment with the orange and the assumption that no other effect was in operation, created this whole Earth as the center of the universe thing that basically all science was based on, you know, for the next 1,400 years. And the reality is there was another phenomenon at work that Sir Isaac Newton made clear to us. And so for this whole expanding universe and Big Bang theory to rest on that one piece of evidence, the observed redshift, and an assumption that nothing else can cause it, that's bad science right there. Even Edwin Hubble, who discovered the redshift, didn't make that leap. He didn't say this proves the universe is expanding. He just said the further objects are, the more they've got a redshift. And his thinking at the time was something may be happening across those vast distances to shift that frequency. We got to take another commercial break here. You want to stick around for another segment?
I'll go on the other side, I promise.
All right, we'll see you back here after these words from our sponsors. Coming up in the last segment of the show, if you want to join us on the air for Physics Today, I guess we've changed the tone of the show, 800-259-9231. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
You're listening to the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Ethan in the control room is telling me the phone lines are loaded up and we've only got one segment left, so let's go to Tom in Sweden. Tom, aloha. I understand you have a question for Clarence.
Ah, good morning, Mr. Rivero, and good afternoon, Clarence. It's Thomas over here in Sweden.
Oh, apparently Clarence just dropped, and so I'm sorry, Tom, is there anything else on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I wanted to sort of tie bits of the program together. don't we, let's say, here in very Christian Europe, don't we, aren't we heavily indebted to the Islamic Arabic world for preserving science while we were so busy torturing each other for believing what we observed rather than what we read in a book?
That's absolutely true. Much of what we know about the ancient world comes through Arabic translations of classic works that were destroyed by the Christians. It's, for example, the Library of Alexandria.
Okay, thank you. I'm still worried about the magnetic forces bringing down tall buildings.
Well,
I have nails. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, don't take a compass with you to the skyscraper because that'll just bring it right down on you.
That was the last fellow. There are a lot of other people who have something much more intelligent than I do to say, so I'll let them through. Thank you very much. You have a great weekend, you and your missus. Keeping safe and well.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Aloha. We're going to shift over to Dave in Washington. Dave, aloha. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mike. Thanks. I really appreciate your show. You were talking about physics and the black holes and stuff, and I think one of the fundamental mistakes being made by science today and by NASA and Goddard and JPL is that outer space is electrically neutral. And hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
Oh, sorry. These organizations, one of the axioms of their science is that outer space is electrically neutral and that there are no electric effects on objects as they enter solar systems or galaxies or near black holes. And when you're at the discussion you've had today, mostly relates to particles bumping into each other. And we really don't live in a universe that operates by particles bumping into each other. It actually operates in electric fields. And I think what the science is heading towards is a realization that the sun and the solar system is actually a capacitor, that the sun charges this capacitor by the fusion on its surface, that there is an electricity put into this huge battery we call the solar system, and planets and comets discharge that battery. We are constantly discharging that electric field that operates in the solar system, and a good way to witness it is to see a comet come in, because a comet comes in at a different angle than planets. We're in a kind of a level field as far as the capacitor goes, but a comet comes in from a sharp angle and it really discharges that capacitor. And that's why that's actually the fundamental axiom that you don't hear anywhere, especially in places like the Weather Channel. And these are people who think, you know, particles from the sun heat up particles on the earth and then we get hurricanes. And it's just not that way. We're actually plugged in like a toaster to a wall outlet, which is the sun, and our weather is driven by the release of that electric capacitor. And
here's the problem I have with that. I've heard this theory many, many times before, and there is no question that a great deal of energy flows out from the sun to the rest of the solar system, but I think the capacitance of the system is really going to be very low, given the very large gap, as it were, between the cathode and the anode, if you will, and the very small size of the planets, which would essentially be the storage element for that charge. I'm sure there's probably a small charge there, but I think the effects are rather minimal compared to some of the other. And ultimately, you know, when you talk about an electrical field, what is electricity? It's the movement and storage of electrons. What are electrons? They're particles. So we're back to that whole situation again.
Here's where the capacitor lies. It's not on the sun. The sun is one aspect of the capacitor, and then the outer edge is way beyond Pluto. There's this cloud.
The Oort cloud.
Well, that's rocks, there's a cloud of charged particles on one side, and the other side is the sun. So we're in the center of the capacitor, and there's the plasma effects. You can witness them when remember that comet that came in recently, and it lit up huge in the sky. They said it was like the biggest thing in the solar system. I forget what the name of it was, and it created this huge blue ball of gas around it, And
okay, well, I need to wrap up with you because we've got to go to another caller. But in essence, comets shine by light reflected from the sun. There is no evidence to indicate that they are luminous in and of themselves. You know, they're always measured with photocells and stuff. Real
I'll
quick, because we've got to go to David in California.
Yeah. The website for anybody who wants to understand this is Professor James McCanney, and it's jmcanneyscience.com. And he has a radio show, and he is a professor from Cornell, and he's written many books on the subject. And his explanations, he can explain anything from an atom to a black hole.
All right, we've got to go along here. And
thank you, Mike.
All right, so we're going to go to Dave in California. Dave, aloha. What's on your mind?
Aloha, Michael. Can you
aloha?
Hear me?
Yeah, I can. What's on your mind?
Okay, thanks. Well, I can't believe you guys are discussing physics. It's so pre-9/11. You know, I mean, everything has changed. You know, fundamentally, steel no longer can acts like steel. Moving bodies no longer act like moving bodies. You know, steel can
shatter. Yeah, and
those
compasses they give out in the Cracker Jack's box can pull down skyscrapers now, apparently. That's
exactly
the theory.
But I do have a theory for that, though.
What's that?
On 9/11, we got hit by a massive storm of dark matter.
Nah. Now, wait a minute. That sounds racist to me.
Obama seems to have survived.
There's two things we will not tolerate on this show, racism and Mexicans on the beach. So, apologies to the Mexicans out there. It was only a joke. Don't call into the show. Don't write into the show. It does seem, and again, you know, science very often gets abused for personal agenda. We're seeing science get abused for religion. We're seeing science get abused for politics, like with global warming. And now they're, you know, the U.S. government is trying to cover up for the 9/11 incident by trying to wave something that sounds scientific at us, not realizing that a lot of people out here in the blogosphere are themselves scientific experts. And now that we can share information with each other, these pseudo-scientific explanations don't survive very long. And that really is the great democratizing phenomenon of the blogosphere. And in the end, what we're witnessing here is a revolution of information flow within civilization that is as fundamentally changing to society as Gutenberg's movable type. And we're seeing the ruling classes today react to the Internet pretty much the way the ruling classes of Gutenberg's time reacted to the availability of very inexpensive printing back when that happened.
I fully agree with that. And I believe Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book or a story about it at one point where he said that, or he was talking about the information technology exploding in the future for him, which would be now, and that at some point wars such things as wars were no longer possible to continue because there was so much information flow that as soon as somebody did something, it was all over the world, they were exposed, and it was basically immediately fell apart. I think we may be seeing that now, and it seems to be a struggle between the two.
I would agree because, for the first time in history, the lies used to start a war, i.e. Iraq, are exposed to the world while that war is still ongoing. And I think it's the Internet is the reason why we have not already invaded Iran. I think the Internet is going to prevent the next global thermonuclear war, I certainly hope. And, the ruling classes are going to have to learn a whole new set of ways to interact with their populations. And those governments that cannot evolve to deal with a new reality are going to go extinct. Nick, Dave, thank you very much for the call. Nick, I'm sorry we didn't get back to you. Call in again during next week. Monday, we start again with new news, calls, physics. Maybe we'll get into biology. Cooking. We haven't done a cooking show yet. So we'll be back on Monday. Until then, aloha. Stay safe. Be well. Aloha, America.